It was the year of deep geeking.
The year of Feedbackapalooza.
The year we discussed our favorite show.
It was the year without Zima.
The year of great tequila.
The year of puns.
And a year of more interviews.
It was a new chance for fun.
It was the end of the series.
It was the year we made it to Crusade.
The year is 2009. The show, Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I am Tim Callender.
And it's Kashi Poo in Los Angeles with a Kashapalooza tonight, folks.
Yeah, I know. This is going to be fun.
It's going to be a hoot. It always is whenever I'm with you guys and we bring guests to the house. Insanity usually follows right after.
I don't know that this podcast can handle more than one Vorlon at a time, but we'll see.
It seems like it's a very small room about to get very much smaller, right?
There's going to be a rip in the time-space continuum or something. I'm pretty sure of it.
Okay, but, Summer, here's our moment. We got to do this, and you can't let me down, okay?
I'll try.
You got it. Okay. Menengay, are you there? Are you there with us, Michael? Are you busy working on
something? I'm here.
Okay, you guys, do not let me flail out here in the breeze by myself. You ready? Happy birthday to Tim.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday, dear Major Babylon 5 podcaster guy.
Happy birthday to you.
Yes, May 12th was Tim Callender's birthday and
yes,
Bruce Boxleitner's birthday.
Yeah. How cool are you changing your birthday to match up with his? You are a serious.
I think he changed his birthday to match mine.
Yeah. That's frankly not what it said on the bathroom wall. I'm telling you that.
Well, we had to meet in the middle, actually, when all was said and done. And I can tell you, he's not nearly as good looking as I am.
Oh, well, you know, there's another important thing that happens on May 12th. As you know, I always have the ultimate list of cool things that are happening when we do these shows. May 12th, your birthday, was also Migratory Bird Day.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes.
Right.
Absolutely. So birds of a feather flock together, I suppose. And yeah, the day right before that was Eat What You Want Day, but we already know about that. You ready for a few more of them while I'm doing this? Come on. I'm on a roll.
Yeah, go.
All right,
go.
May 15th, National Mole Day.
What kind of
mole? Is it the hairy one or is it the one underground?
We're talking underground here. Yeah. I don't know, Mike. I suppose if that day was issued by the dermatologists of America, that might be the National Mole Day. I assume it was the underground.
I've been saving up for that day.
And then there's also May 15th was Hug Your Cat Day. Okay, yeah, I'm sure we connected with a lot of the fan base there.
Yeah, we all know about petting the kitties. That's fine.
I know that goes back to Eve. That goes back to Eat What You Want Day.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Oh, yeah, we're going there. Absolutely. However, the fans aren't hearing the show until the week of May 20th, or not the week of May 20th, but the show will launch, right, Brad, on May 20th. Yeah. So let's see what's going on here. May 18th, International Museum Day. Of course, you know, the big ones, Armed Forces Day, Victoria Day, and Ascension Day are all happening. And then Maritime Day, which is, I guess, now called National Maritime Day, I think is now called Flag Day, right? Is that?
Mm-hmm.
Do I have?
I think that's right.
But here's the important.
Flag Day was in June.
Well, you might be right about that. You might be right about that. It just comes up here as National Maritime Day. So if you have a maritime, enjoy it on May 22nd, okay?
I'm going to go make some maritime right now.
There you go. Add ice. It always works. Shake, not stirred. Here's one of the important ones. This is one for you, Tim, on your birthday, and now that you're an aged man and need some help in this area. May 23rd is Mesmerism Day.
Ooh.
Dr. Franz Anton Mesmer. from born on May 23rd, 1734. He died 1815, was an Austrian physicist considered to be the father of the mental health industry. He used his practice of mesmerism, combining hypnotism and the power of suggestion to cure his patients. Or test his patience, depending on how you want to work with me here on this one.
Yeah,
May 25th is Jazz Day. May 26th is Neighbor Day.
All right.
No, exactly. So
go enjoy your neighbor.
Go enjoy your neighbor. Getting
or
back
at least
to
your neighbor's wife.
Exactly.
Yes.
And we're going to wrap up this week with May 28th, Return of the Slugs Day.
The movie?
I kid you not. Return of the Slugs Day is a California celebration steeped in tradition, celebrated in Capistrano, California. Yes, that's the same place where the swallows swallow, or
right.
What you want day.
They swallow slugs.
May 28th. Yeah, exactly. That's when the slugs make their pilgrimage back to the patios and gardens of the Capistrano residence. And there's a text coming into the hotline right now. So
so the swallows fly in and then the grubs kick them out.
Right. Is there any creature that doesn't return to Capistrano? I mean, this is kind of silly.
Hippies often return back there. Yeah.
Yeah. The Borlons have always been in Capistrano.
It is kind of the edge of the rim. Yeah. It's sort of like south of the border when you're going down the 95 there.
If you go to Capistrano, you will be migratory.
Yeah, exactly. So I've got some more great ones after when we get into next week's show. But there you go, kids. That's my job, that as a Vorlon, I keep you informed and give you a reason to celebrate.
I'm building you a bumper for this segment because it's becoming its own segment now.
Oh, good. I've got something up on Gary now.
I don't know. Just wait till the next feedback of Palooza.
Oh, that's... It'll be fun.
Dear Gary, got you beat this time.
On that note, I think we're going to take a breather because we need
Kashapalooza.
We need to prepare ourselves for the Kashiness. So happy birthday, Tim. Happy birthday, Bruce. Everybody, brace yourselves.
Thanks for Bruce.
Many,
on
many
behalf of Mr. Box Lightner, I accept this cake.
Can't Stop the Serenity 2009, worldwide charity screenings for equality now. Joss Whedon's Serenity is on the big screen again to benefit his favorite charity, Equality Now. We've raised over $250,000 since 2006, but we need your help again. Also featuring the theatrical debut of Dr. Horrible's Sing-Along Blog. Visit CantStopTheSerenity.com to find a local screening near you.
Hello, Russ, it's Jeffrey.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent. You got a few minutes?
Yeah, sure. Please.
Fantastic. Russ, I want you to meet Tim and Summer. Tim and Summer, say hi to Russ Johnson.
Hi to Russ Johnson.
Hello, gentlemen who I don't know.
and lady, but that's not me. I'm the gentleman. Well,
fair enough.
Yeah. Well, so they say. So for those of you who don't know, Russ was my predecessor. He's the original Kosh. He's the guy that was in the suit. True or false, Russ?
Well, you know, true and false, I have to say. And I don't have as good a knowledge of what came before the series as you, but there was someone else before either of us who in the actual pilot, the TV movie, would have been wearing it. So.
And you don't know who that was?
That's the mystery name. No, when we got the job, when Optic Nerve got the job to do the series, everything that had come before, all of the designs, the actual suit itself, just sort of showed up on our doorstep one morning. So, yeah, it was sort of like an orphan child.
So Russ, why don't we start there? Let's go back. Tell us a little bit about you coming to Optic Nerve and how that led to Babylon 5.
Yeah, no, I was working at Optic Nerve as it was one of those kind of weird deals where I just started. I started working for them. They were doing a number of pictures down at Corman Films, an interesting experience in and of itself. And I was just hired to be a runner for a week. And at the end of the week, you know, the boss said, well, we may have a little work, you know, come back in on Monday. And then, you know, at the end of the next week, it was like, well, you, we've got a little more work, come back in on Monday. So that basically went on for like 2 years. And it was sort of like in, you know, the Princess Bride, when it's like, you've done a fine job, it's wonderful, now I shall probably kill you. And, you know, then you continue to work. And in the course of that, they got the series Babylon 5. And so I kind of got upgraded from general all-around grunt to production coordinator and on-set puppeteer creature guy. And it was kind of a Cinderella story because, as I said, the suit had already been created for the TV movie and showed up in a crate. And, of course, you know, as soon as we got it, you know, we ripped it open. And, you know, you got a shop full of nerds all very excited about their work. And we pulled the suit out and everybody's trying it on and running around in it and, you know, wearing it like a dress. And then everybody, like, tried to put on the helmet. And literally, I was the only one with a head small enough for it to fit. So that is how I was cast in the part. It was not my fine miming skills or anything beyond that. It's just the suit fit.
Now, were you excited to be wearing the helmet? I mean, was this something everyone was vying for to get inside the suit? Or was it, like you say, it's a Cinderella story, so obviously the glass slipper fit, but did you want the slipper to fit?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have to understand. I mean, it was a great place to work. I mean, it was a great time to be there. I mean, everybody there was, you know, very excited to be working on the show. Where, you know, we're all science fiction fans. We're all kind of, you know, dyed-in-the-wool nerds. So the thought that this would be a way, it's like somebody's going to pay me to do this was like fantastic.
All right, so what was the first scene you shot wearing the Kosh encounter suit?
Oh, gosh. You know, I'm not 100% sure. To be honest, it was I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of the first series, but it was what we shot as the pilot. I don't think it necessarily even aired as the first show was like the plague or the disease or the guy who gets hit by the alien bug that turns him into warrior monster. Yeah. So yeah,
infection, sure.
Infection. So that, and I was pulling double duty because I was also, at the time, they'd envisioned this, you know, really dramatic and sort of, at the time it seemed ambitious, drug-dealing cricket who lived down in whatever, like the Brown sector, the McGrath character. So I was wearing both of those suits. So I lost about 5 pounds during the course of the filming of Infection because it wasn't covered in latex. I was in the howitzer, and so it was one or the other for about a week.
That's so great. Now, was that or was that not the single most uncomfortable piece of garb you have ever put on your body?
Well, you know, the from the neck down, it's very free flowing. It's actually quite comfortable. You can be wearing, you know, anything or nothing, but
yeah,
the helmet.
That's how you lost the gig, right? Because you were commando all the time.
And as it turns out, you know, some of the female extras were not cool with that.
After the lawsuit was settled, then what happened?
After all the restraining orders were dealt with, then I was able to work again in the United States. Everything below the neck was fine. The helmet was, even though, I mean, I managed to fit it, it was a little tight. And the one thing that was, you know, always, I think I still have a small little dot in my forehead where the ear, the little cervix that would work the iris, would dig right into my temple. Yeah. And like certain, you know, depending on who was puppeteering it, some people like turn that thing off and on like every 5 seconds. Like it was open, yes. Shut, open, shut, open, shut. And so it was like digging right into my forehead.
Yeah.
That part was less than fun.
Yeah. Yeah. The servo that he's talking about would open and close the iris on the front, and it would make a little noise. You could hear it inside the helmet, and it would. And you could tell if you had somebody who really knew, the puppeteer that really knew what they were doing. Hey, no, wait, let me say, they all knew what they were doing. It's just some were a little more zealous and trying to, you know, they were creating a Rambo character and others were creating this insightful, mysterious Vorlon, you know. So some people would be like, you know, and then others ones would be like, you know, xylophone or like scratching at the disco.
Yeah. And those are the ones that would draw blood.
Yeah, and that thing was hot too. That, I mean, the whole helmet was hot because here's shocking news: fiberglass is not a breathable material. But the little servo would actually get hot and would burn a hole in your head. It really would.
So was there no padding or anything in the helmet?
There was padding for the sides, but that was the one thing that you just couldn't really. Yeah. You know, they couldn't put rubber on it. It had to be flexible enough to open and close. So it was pretty much just a deal with it. You're getting paid. Shut up.
Yeah.
Kind of a deal.
Now, you see, here's the other thing is I don't think you had this because you are a handsome, well-structured face kind of guy. Okay. I have a nose about the size of Jupiter and trying to get my nose inside the we're talking about the original Kosh helmet. The original Kosh, just the only way to do it, I had to squish my nose against my upper lip.
And I had to do the entire show like this, you know, because I was like,
yeah.
I was going to say, so how long did that helmet last before you guys ran it over accidentally with a dolly?
I would imagine that original helmet's still kicking around, right?
It was there the entire time that I was there.
Yeah,
and,
there was only that one helmet.
I was only retired when they changed characters or, you know, changed costumes, to the best of my knowledge. Now, I do have one good destruction anecdote that I don't know if it's public knowledge or not. You may know this, Jeffrey. But the episode, and again, forgive me, I can't remember the title of it, but one of the ones in the first season where you first that it's like, well, you know, the Kosh character of Vorlons are creatures of light, the helmet comes off and a beam of light comes out and it's like, oh, they're, you know, they're energy people. That, to do that, what Optic Nerve had decided and production had decided was to pull, positives off the old suit. They made a new fiberglass shoulder encasing, made a new helmet. All is like a stunt thing that they built with a hinge on the back that had a little lever that would then, you know, lift perfectly up, and then, you know, stick a 2K in the bottom and the light would go out and it was going to be this whole thing. They repainted it, all very elaborate.
Yes.
And it was so, you know, it was like so crushed in terms of the schedule. It was like literally they were just finishing it the day it was supposed to shoot. And I mean, stop me if you've heard this. I went to go pick it up to bring it back to the set to do the shoot. And literally the paint was drying and we were going to put it in the flatbed of my truck. And so I started laying it down and the guy who was the shop foreman at the time was like, no, that'll smudge the paint. Don't do that. Just have it up, have it standing up. I was like, I don't know. That doesn't seem like a very good idea. He's like, no, you've got to do that. Here, we'll just take this PA. We'll put him in the back of your truck. He'll hold on to it. It'll be fine. Okay, so we are driving down the 5, a large, you know, 4-lane highway on the way to the set, and all of a sudden I hear this squeal. I mean, like a giant squirrel in the flatbed, and I turn around. And this kid has turned pale white. He's literally squealing as the fiberglass top and the head peels off of the body and goes flying into the middle of the highway. And I mean, it's all happening in slow motion, and I'm just seeing, you know, my job, you know, my life as I know it, you know, being destroyed. But the thing that's amazing is it was so well made, it didn't blow up on the highway. I mean, it was still there, sitting in the middle of the highway. So I pulled off to the side of the road, and literally was prepared to. I like walked out into one lane, and I was going to go get it. I was convinced I could get it, and we can save it, and it was going to be okay. And I swear to God, this guy in a huge, like, bright red Dodge Ram swerved not to avoid it, but to hit it. And literally moved into the lane, hit it, and the whole thing just disappeared in a cloud of fiberglass. That was it. It was gone. And so I had to crawl back to set with that news. And fortunately, again, I mean, the guys at Optic Nerve were very smart and very clever and did what we probably should have done in the first place, which was just jury-rig the old suit for the head to come off in the light, and everything went fine. But at the time, I was, you know, I was pretty much convinced that that was it. I'd never eat lunch in this town again, if you will.
Yeah. I think we traced the license plate on that truck, and it turned out that a guy named Morden owned it, right?
Either that or somebody, Rick Berman, or somebody working on Star Trek.
Wow, I do remember that story. That must have been so painful for you.
Yeah, well, it was a little painful to watch, but again, happy ending, so you can't complain.
Right. The other thing that I remember, Russ, about that suit was it was so, whoever it was originally built for had spinal problems because the thing was so imbalanced. Do you recall that? Like it just.
Oh yeah. It had a tendency to lean you naturally forward, and again, like I said, I'm not sure. I can't remember the first person it was actually designed for, but I don't think it was designed to be comfortable for any human, and that's why when they started talking about early ideas about, well, let's put him on roller skates, or let's you know, something to really, like, you know, enhance that floating thing. I had to, you know, raise my hand and object, because if walking was as difficult as that, I didn't think that putting the whole show on wheels was going to be an especially good idea. Because, and here's the other thing, and maybe this was changed when the suit was, you know, was later redone, but the other sort of bonehead move that was built into the show was the suit was designed wider than most of the doors on the set.
Right.
So you will notice that there's not a lot of scenes where you actually, other than like elevators, where you see like Tosh coming through a door. You see him outside a door, somebody talks, and then he's mysteriously inside, because right. You literally have to turn sideways
yeah.
in a most sort of, you know, embarrassing and awkward fashion.
Yeah.
So how was this, that shoulder harness and shower curtain assemble worn? I mean, by what method was it attached to your body?
You know, it was, the best I can tell is probably like a Mardi Gras costume. I mean, it was, as you say, sort of a harness that just had to be lifted up over onto you and then sort of worn like a very unattractive backpack.
Yeah. No, at its root was a backpack frame, or at least a fabricated one for the first Kosh, and it was a legitimate, nice ABS, you know, high tech one for the second Kosh. Right? I mean, it was
improvements.
Yeah. Oh, I was there when they started it, and I had them build it around me, and that made all the difference, because it was like jumping into a Ferrari after that first one. I mean, it was nice.
Yeah, and I was going to say, Russ, you know, you started off the interview telling us how cool it was to get the job. At what point in time did you stand there wearing this thing going, be careful what you wish for?
Probably the first time somebody showed me a picture of myself after they like take the helmet off, and I'm standing there covered in sweat and stank and the whole thing. You know, I have to admit, I tried to be diligent about it because it was my own, you know, business, but it's not like they alcoholed that thing down on a regular basis. So it was kind of one of the guys on the show lovingly referred to it as the fart bong. So you can imagine that it was not always the most, like, you know, fragrant place on the set.
Yeah. No, I just right before we started recording tonight, I picked up. I was going through an old box here and came up with an issue of Sci-Fi Entertainment, the official magazine of the Sci-Fi Channel. And let's see, this is dated February of 97, and there was a little interview with me about the suit. And here's a quote that I apparently shot my mouth off about. It says, the suit can be claustrophobic and difficult to work in as well. You cannot comprehend what it's like to spend that much time in such close proximity to yourself. I have an inch by an eighth of an inch people on either side of me. And it points to precarious places that doesn't give me a right view, and it just gives me an awkward view, and I try to rehearse the scenes, blah, 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 blah. I go on and on. But it was... I swear I still have Russ's DNA on me, and I can't imagine what happened to, you know.
That's true. But it was like being in your own isolation tank. It was like altered states, minus, you know, the orangutan business.
Oh, man.
In fact, I never did peyote in the suit, but I almost feel like I should have. Now, looking back, that probably would have been a great experience.
I have to wonder what the set was like, because we've got bongs, we've got peyote, all inside the Vorlon suit here. What were you guys really doing? Mm. What was in the inspiration?
Just trying to make a living.
That's right. It was.
So we know now that the gliding was pharmaceutically enhanced.
Precisely.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll go with that story. That's good. Yeah.
Just say no.
Now, yeah. Russ, did you have to learn the lines when you were in the suit? Were you actually rehearsing dialogue and speaking dialogue with the other cast when you were in the suit?
I did, just to the extent, obviously, that it could be timed with the other actors. I mean, it was very difficult to hear someone talking with that helmet on. But, you know, I have to say that one of the things that was great about it is, you know, most of the actors, and especially the other actors who were performing in prosthetics, or, you know, Peter and Mira and Andreas, I mean, were always great about trying to, you know, encourage you or be like, you know, oh, that's, you know, I appreciate what you were giving me, you know, in the scene, and, you know, and like making you a part of the performance. Although, as I always say, it's like, look, I can only move my head in six directions. So it's not like I'm giving you some Brando thing here. It's like, should I move my head back or to the left? Maybe I'll go right this time. It was not what you'd call Stella Adler material. And yet they were always very gracious about, trying to include you as one of the cast.
I think in those early days of Kasha's, revealing that who that character was, Russ was blessed that most of his lines were yes and no.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, there wasn't a lot of big speeches. They were all very cryptic. And, the rain is green in Arabic. Whatever. Okay.
Yeah.
Head to the left, head to the right. Iris once, done.
Now, we also had a little, remember, we had a little hand device that had, what, four or five buttons on it, and that worked a little twinkly box on the chest?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about the twinkly box. Yeah, well, obviously, you try to use that to best, as best you could.
That was like an early Hawking's kind of thing, right, Stephen Hawking?
I am talking, I'll see my lights.
And just just another element of the performance.
Did you ever fall over in the thing?
I have to say that is the one indignity that I was spared. I did not fall over in the costume.
Now, Jeffrey has told us that when he was performing in the Kosh suit, he went to Joe Straczynski and asked about his performance. What was Joe looking for? Was he hitting what he wanted? And Joe's basic response was, when you don't do it right, I'll let you know. So did you ever have a discussion about your performance as Kosh with JMS?
I did not. Like I said, I mean, I sort of at that time, you know, I embraced my status as a glorified prop. And I knew that if I was hitting the mark and, you know, not spasming and giving the other actors enough time to say their lines, that appeared to be getting the job done. And I just assumed, based on our others, you know, we had other interactions with him just as the effects team, as the physical effects team, as the makeup effects team, and that general philosophy of, if you're doing it wrong, don't worry, I'll let you know, seemed to be the order of the day. So I guess I just figured if there was an issue, you know, it'll show up in my mailbox.
Mm-hmm. You played other characters too, didn't you?
Well, yeah, pretty much any, you know, anything that required a lanky guy with a small head in season one, you can guess that was me. The McGrath character, the almond-eyed alien in the court scene. Hell, I even puppeteered Londo's penis. I'd say that was probably the highlight.
When we were playing cards, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So
that was great.
Yeah, that was my highlight. It's kind of like, boy, my parents are proud they sent me to college for that.
So you played the gray on trial?
What's that?
I said you played the gray alien who was on trial?
Yes, in the Silver Lame.
Yeah.
That picture still haunts me, I can assure you. Talk about things that show up at your bachelor party.
So let's go off set for a minute. Tell us a little bit more about the inner workings at Optic Nerve and what that what happened when you guys didn't show up to see, because these guys, you know, the whole team and the Optic Nerve team was always fantastic. Wait. Before I go down this path, here's what I want to say about Russ. Is Russ, I owe my Kosh career to Russ, because when I first got the part, he was the puppeteer in charge to work with me and to show me how to put it on and how to guide me and how to, so he taught me, Russ taught me everything I know about being Kosh. and I'm still grateful to this day, because I still get annoying email and things sent to me from people. But what was it like at Optic Nerve when you guys would, you know, weren't on set with us?
It was, as I said, I mean, that was a great year. It was an exciting show to work on because, you know, we were all genre fans. We were all people who, you know, had watched all that kind of programming and certainly appreciated the, you know, the things that Joe was trying to do. And you know, and trying to do different. I mean, I'll say right out of the gate, it was like a competition to be the not Star Trek. And that's not a knock against Star Trek. It's just that obviously they had a very specific, you know, thing they were doing and a specific look. And the guys who worked at Optic Nerve were, you know, they were kind of unleashed. And, you know, you had a lot of really, really artistic sculptors and painters and what have you who, you know, who were told, hey, you don't just have to do forehead and ear appliances, you know, go nuts. And they did. And it went, you know, and it was great. So that was all very exciting. And I even, you know, I would work with all of the background aliens and do even some like light applications for, you know, background, big background scenes. And it was just exciting. I mean, you know, that was the year, you know, I guess it was Parliament of Dreams. They won the Emmy. They you know, upset, you know, the dynasty and, you know, all that work was recognized. So it was just, it was very cool. It was cool in every way. And it was just a great, job for a young guy, you know, who's new to Los Angeles to have. Because, again, everybody was so passionate about what they did. It wasn't just like, oh, you know, I'm just doing this and, you know, but eventually I want to direct.
So Russ, why did you not return to the role of Kosh once Jeffrey came on the scene?
I left Optic Nerve after a little while because I had other things that I wanted to try. I actually ended up working for a Paramount touring show, doing, you know, some legitimate kind of you could call it theater work. It was more like Star Trek on Ice. to be totally honest. And just to do other things, I ended up coming back to Optic Nerve some years later to work on some other projects. But I guess I just always sort of, at that time, I was in sort of a, you know, looking mode. I just enjoyed doing different things. So rather than stick with that, I tried some different career paths.
Sure. Now, did you give Jeffrey any hint of what he was in for by wearing that suit, or did you just say, thumbs up, buddy, it's going to be the time of your life?
I think he got a hint the second he put that helmet on, like you said, and got that dose of DNA and, like, you know, 1 year's worth of stank. I don't think words can describe it. I mean, I think it was all said in an aroma for what he was in for. And he still seemed game, so, you know, and obviously, you know, did well.
My audition was much like yours. I've always proclaimed that the only reason I even got the part was because the stupid helmet fit my head.
That's a big part of it. It's the Johnny Bravo syndrome.
Absolutely right. Right.
It's the suit.
I think it's because you and I are probably the only two people to ever appear on B5 that didn't have an ego so large that it wouldn't fit inside the helmet.
Whoa!
Hey now.
Oh.
Now, Russ and I had a wonderful opportunity. We reconnected this past February in Washington, D.C. at a business conference for television producers. And what a shock. It was so cool. I think we saw each other like in the halls or something and kind of did one of those, oh, man, what show was it that I worked with that guy? You know, I know that face. I know. Yeah, exactly. You know, And then Russ got it, man, and he came marching over to me at a what was that? That was like a cocktail hour.
Many cocktail hours.
Yeah. Exactly. And he says, "You're Jeffrey, aren't you?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I saw you. Who the hell are you?" And he's, because you see, we're both considerably older now and grayer, and you know, far more handsome than we were originally. And it was a wonderful delight and surprise. Tell us what you're doing now, Russ.
Well, I work in the Dallas-Fort Worth area as a writer-producer. I've done several years. I was a senior writer on a biography show about alternative healthcare, which I know that's a far cry, a dramatic change from, you know, science fiction to alternative healthcare, although not as big as you might think in some instances. pretty close. And now work for another production company who is doing programming for that same network, the Natural Health and Wellness Network, that I shall not name because they don't even deserve the free publicity. But so now I'm just working in development and writing and producing in Dallas, and doing the occasional acting gig just for fun, although usually helmetless whenever possible.
Do you stay in touch with your old Optic Nerve friends at all?
I do. I just talked to actually Everett Burrell last night.
Oh, yeah. Everett. Everett was one of the principals of Optic Nerve.
Yeah, he was one of the co-owners and and one of the head on-set makeup guy. Yeah, no. Because, again, like I said, it was a great time. It was a great time. And a lot of definitive friendships and relationships were formed. So, I mean, I wouldn't trade it for anything. I was ready to go when I went, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. Good people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Russ, just to let you know, Jeffrey let us know that you were coming on the show. So we put out the call to our listeners for questions. And actually, in the course of this interview, you've answered most everything that was going to be asked, whether you knew it or not. But I do have one. Yeah, no, it's great. But we have one last question here. This comes from an official contributor, Gary, in Jacksonville. He wants to know, are you ever confused with Russell Johnson, who played the professor on Gilligan's Island?
One significant, yes. I'd say one in five people that I meet immediately go to that reference. Ooh, like the professor. But... once when I was when I was still living in Los Angeles, I went to a Kinko's to photocopy a script, and I gave it to the guy behind the counter, and, you know, he was photocopying it, and while it was happening, he kind of sidled over to me, and he's like, so, So what's going on? You know, like, are they going to do that reunion? No, and at the moment, I had no idea what he was talking about. I'm like, I'm sorry? He's like, well, yeah, you know. Because my name was on the script, and I guess he'd seen it. He's like, hey, they're going to like to do the Gilligan's Island thing? And I was like, no, I get it. No, I'm sorry. I'm not related to Russell Johnson. I'm not his son. I'm not his nephew. I'm not related. And he's like, no, come on, man. You can tell me. I mean, you're convinced. And like, he somehow caught me in this, in this, ooh, big fame lie. And I was like, no, really, I'm not. And he's like, dude, come on. Just tell me. Then he starts getting mad. It's like, and I'm like, look, I promise you, in no way am I related to Russell Johnson on Gilligan's Island. And then he takes a beat and he looks at me and he goes, fuck you. He wasn't that cool anyway. So, it does happen on occasion, but that's easily my favorite exchange.
Wow.
That's fantastic.
Only in Hollywood.
Exactly.
Okay, so here's my last question. Russell Johnson. Ginger or Marianne?
Marianne.
All right.
Yes. Yes.
Girl next door, way to go.
Absolutely, wins every time.
Without question. I could just, I have no time for that tarted up tramp.
that's right, stuff. There's movie cameras and radios to Jerry Rig.
yeah, exactly. And apparently the woman is not shy about mailing you a joint, if that's your thing.
Wow.
Really?
There's some insight. That's another show.
just throwing it out there. Just dropped that bomb in the room, but now I got to go.
Well, thank you for creating our Kashapalooza for tonight. Did you meet Ard White? Did you get a chance to talk with him and party with him?
Who?
Ard White Chamberlain. Did the voice of Kosh?
No, I never did.
Wow. Okay.
We lived separate lives.
No.
Like the people in Love Letters, we just never met. When ships passing in the night.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, wow. I should have known we would be in for this with two Koshes in the same room.
Yeah, it could get worse. Maybe we should do this as a recurring theme, especially when we don't have anything good planned for the next episode. We'll just call Russ up again and we'll beat this dead horse.
Happy to be your sloppy seconds. Yeah,
that's very nice. All right. Excellent. Russ, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yes, no, thank you very much.
I mean, it was good seeing you in Washington, and yeah, this was a lot of fun.
All right, sir. We'll do it again soon. Thank you again. Have a great evening.
Okay, talk to you later.
Hey, are you into hacking your iPod and learning some cool computer tricks?
Nobody wants to hear about that stuff. Do you want to learn about cool gaming tricks and tips?
Gaming is stupid. Come on, people want a podcast about upgrading their TiVos and cool utilities.
No, people want a podcast about the geek lifestyle.
I don't know what podcast you're talking about, but all the great tech stuff is on the GeekCast.
Really? Well, all the great gaming and movie stuff is on the GeekCast, too.
If you're looking for the best alternative to Internet Explorer, using great RAM on your Mac or stealth ways to secure your PC, the GeekCast is the podcast for you.
If you're looking for geek jargon, movie references, and gaming talk, then the GeekCast is the podcast for you.
From secret Contra codes
to programming and Fortran, the GeekCast is the podcast for you.
Come check us out at www.geekcastonline.com
or search the GeekCast on iTunes.
The GeekCast, podcasting at the speed of the internet.
We're ready to believe you.
I don't know if there's a way to recover from that much Vorlon influence.
I don't think that I've told this story on the podcast. I know I've done it in conventions because it's more of a physical gag. But if you'll allow me, there was something that Russ said that triggered a memory. listen to me, triggered a memory, but I have no idea what episode that was in. I know that I was trying to walk out of the elevator in the Kosh suit. And if you recall, that was sort of like an angled door, you know? It wasn't like a perpendicular. It had a strange angle to it. And when it would open all the way, it wouldn't completely recess into the wall. And as I came out of the door, you know, cameras are rolling, and I come flying out the door, and I caught the corner of the big toilet seat, you know, on the edge of the door. It just nicked it, you know? And that was enough to kind of spin my shoulders, which, you know, I'm already in this precarious position of trying to balance and keep a center of gravity, and it knocked my center of gravity, and I started tumbling to the right when I just knew that there were all these lights and stuff that were set up there, and it was a moment I thought I was going down. So when you asked Russ, you know, if he ever fell, and he said he didn't, I can take the same claim. I didn't, but man, did I come close. I mean, it was really, that would have been a moment. And the cameras were rolling, so I know that footage exists somewhere. It probably should have been in a or maybe it wasn't funny enough at the time that it made it into one of the bloopers. But boy, had I fallen, you know that John Flynn would have had it right there on camera. And it would have been
bad. Really, Jeffrey, bad. Your back is broken, but man, it was funny when you went down.
Some good stuff right there.
So were there any instances of Vorlons missing the turn and planting their faces into the walls?
No, I don't recall that really. Because, you know, if Kosh was in a scene, it was already pretty clear to us that we couldn't have a lot of set dressing around. I think I've been quoted as saying it was like a bullet in a china shop, because it really was. So, it was pretty obvious you had to kind of leave a fair amount of runway space in either direction. I don't remember there being too much. Maybe, you know, like the most difficult situations would have been any scenes in... Wow. Did we go to the lens room? I imagine we did at some point, right? To have a...
In fact, in the Shadow of Zahadum, there's a scene in Delenn's quarters where Kosh and Delenn are revealing what happened with the Icarus on Zahadum to Sheridan. Yes, but as I recall, it's not like the door opens and they all, you know, file into her quarters and pour a drink and get going. It's like it's a quick cut. You know, come with me, Captain. And then you're standing there.
They put a piece of tape down on the floor and they say, "Stand here, don't move." And I go, "Yes, sir."
I guess we should ask this of Russ, but what did you do with your hands?
Well, your one of the hands is used to operate the. There was a little pistol grip thing that had five or six little buttons on it, and that would work the twinkly lights. So that was what one of the hands would do. And the other one, I'm trying to remember, Tim, what I did. I always had some function. I don't recall if I was kind of holding on to the harness. The backpack to try to give it a little more of, to keep my body integral with the chassis, so to speak. So, it wasn't like I was flailing around or playing with myself. No, it was, I was pretty busy under there, as a rule. But for those listeners who are just kind of going back and rewatching the scenes or the episodes rather, when you see Kosh, most times you're going to see him in the Zocalo or in a hallway or somewhere where there wasn't a lot of stuff
for you to crash spaces.
Into. Yeah, exactly. You know,
50
yard line was a good place for Kosh to be.
Very good. Well, I think we've got a couple voicemails lined up and a few emails, so why don't we go and get to those?
Okay.
Happy birthday to Tim. Happy birthday to Tim. You look like a Pakmara, and you smell like one, too. Happy birthday, Tim. What is this, 29, 39? You let us know. I hope you had a good one. Take care.
46, in fact. And we had chocolate carrion cake, because that's what a Pakmara would have.
That's just wrong on so many levels. Although, I, you know... the really sad part there is that Pachmara and to you don't rhyme, Gary.
Well, it does in the original Minbari.
Old Testament Minbari, yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah. Hello, this is Neil from Bowie calling. I was just listening to show 153 where Jeffrey was talking about the space shuttle. And I'm calling here from Goddard Space Flight Center. There's a nice liftoff on Monday, real nice video of that. And, of course, the whole business with the backup shuttle was because of that was the only way that they could do the Hubble servicing was to have a backup shuttle in case anything went wrong. I mean, originally they weren't going to do the Hubble servicing because of what happened before to the shuttle and fears of anything that would happen, they wouldn't be ready to do anything. So, anyway, that's the story there. And hope everything's going to be working out real well soon. That's all. Bye.
Awesome.
Yep. And in fact, yesterday they captured captured Hubble on the arm.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, Neil from Goddard, you call us any old time. We appreciate that. And any little insight you have for us is always good fodder around here because those are real space stations and space flight, and we always like to make the correlation between the fictional and the non-fictional, but that was I was like don't miss the launch, and I had the TV going, I had the NASA live on my computer, and I said, don't miss the launch, and sure enough, I was on the phone doing a business call, and got off. Oh, whew, great, now I can walk. Oh, I missed the launch. I know they replay it over and over though, but it's great stuff. It really is.
Cool stuff.
Really, although, I got to say, I'm a little, and maybe Neil or some others in space agency world can get back to us a little bit more about this. How hard can it really be? I understand that the shuttle is at a higher orbit. I understand that it's in a different geosynchronous pattern than the space station. Well, actually, the space station's not in geosynchronous. If you're already up there, how much fuel do you really need to go chase down the space station? I mean, why is it that you can't fly to the space station?
From Hubble?
Yeah.
I think it has to do with orbital inclinations. And I won't pretend to understand all the ins and outs of it. But that's the deal. Hubble is sitting at in a different orbital inclination than what the space station is. And changing that vector, that delta V, is where your fuel use comes in. And it does take a significant amount of fuel to get that.
All right. I'm just thinking if I'm trying to get to the space station, it's got to be easier to do that from Hubble than it would be from the ground.
Not necessarily,
right. It's not like if I'm trying to get to San Francisco and I'm at Farpoint Media in Phoenix as opposed to Farpoint Media in Virginia with you, right?
Right. It is some of it is counterintuitive, in the sense that if you want to catch up to an object that's in a higher orbit than what you are, you basically have to drop your orbit to gain speed and then use that additional velocity to help propel you into that higher orbit.
I could get that. I understand.
And vice versa. If you're trying to get to something that's in a lower orbit, you raise your orbit to lose velocity, and then, gravity starts taking over and pulls you down and closer. But it,
Well, so, let's invite some
somebody
smart
out
people.
There knows better than us. Yeah.
Yeah, because we're doing a bad job of it.
Right. Absolutely. And we do that so well.
Hey, Babcasters. It's Gary from Jacksonville. And I'm listening to everybody talk about this whole Gary Cole and Jeffrey speaking about how, he didn't feel he was the perfect fit for the role. It never did make it through the first season. And so maybe we would have had another, second season surprise and, had a new leading man come on. I could definitely see something happen and Gideon being stuck on Earth while it's still under quarantine and he's unable to leave. So they bring someone else from, Earth Force or the Rangers on. if it had kept up, who knows? We might have even seen someone, you know, one of the main stars from Babylon 5 come back in as, you know, leader of the ship. I would have loved to have seen Richard Biggs come in, since it's in a sense a medical mission, and maybe, you know, take over the lead that way. Or, you know, there's always other options too, but maybe if we had seen season two, we might have had the same sort of, you know, leader switch that we saw in Babylon 5. Just some food for thought, guys. Take care. Bye.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, yeah. Dr. Franklin did make an appearance.
Right.
In an episode. And, Summer, you know better than I do, but I understand that the projected season finale for season one of Crusade basically had an assassin with Gideon in his sights. No, not necessarily that, you know, that would have been killing him off, but something drastic would have been happening there.
Something along that line, yes.
Yeah. So.
Yep.
Who knows? It's all conjecture. You know, that's the one, that's the beauty of it and the shame of it when it comes to Crusade.
The great what if.
Exactly. Precisely. All right. I got a couple emails here to go through real quick. Some that have been, you know, we've got a feedback of Palooza coming up, but these have been just kind of hanging and waiting. So, two of these are from relatively new listeners. So the first one comes to us from Bob Langer. He writes, "Hi, Summer, Tim, Jeff, and all the usual suspects. I have heard about your podcast for years, but have only really started listening to them recently. Why now? Well, my script book collection is complete, and I am going through the ultimate Babylon 5 experience. For each episode, I'm doing the following. Watch the episode, read the Lurker's Guide entry, read the script, read the Babylon file entry, and listen to the podcast for that episode."
Wow.
Well, when B5 was first on the air, I did go through the Lurker's Guide whenever a new episode came out, but that was a few years ago. "And only now is there an in-depth archive to provide something unparalleled in exploring the depth of the story. Where your podcast excels in providing a peek behind the scenes. Your podcasts are better than the special features on most DVDs. It is a refreshing in-depth look at the entire series. All in all, folks, I love your podcast. The only suggestion I have is that there be more diverse opinions. I'd love to hear Tim and Summer get into a knockdown, drag-out disagreement over the meaning of an episode. Maybe somewhere in the next 130 podcasts that are already online, I'll see that. I really do love the show. Keep up the excellent work." Yeah, he had a fairly in-depth treatise regarding Survivors, which I elected not to read, not because it was not insightful, but just not pertinent. But yeah, you know, conversations with people like Russ Johnson, that was an excellent in-depth look at something that none of us fans understood what was going on behind the scenes with.
It's a little scary that he's got that kind of time and energy to put into watching a single episode of a television show, that he can go read the book and read the lines and read the this and do all that research. But that is a serious immersion into the B5 yep. universe.
And I think coming up in year 5, he will hear Tim and Summer get into some knockdown dragouts.
Yeah, follow the live feed. That's where the good stuff is.
Oh, no, okay. There's going to be some interesting philosophical digression. What's the word? I'm like, disagreements.
Debate? Yes.
Over certain parts of season 5, and I think it's going to be fun.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. Absolutely. This comes to us from Jim Stiles, Babylon Podcast. "I am really new to podcasts, so I'm gratified to find a podcast devoted to my favorite TV show of all time. Several times in the episode DVD commentaries, JMA said that he did not want most of his military characters to be jingoistic, gung-ho types. A notable exception was Captain Michael Jankowski, commander of the Prometheus. That always struck me as a false note. In the real world, military officers are thoughtful, but they also tend to be enthusiastic about the missions that are assigned to them. Many of the commanders in Babylon 5 appear to me to be more like businessmen than military officers."
Oh, well, yeah. It truly, you know, so much of the other warring ships and things that we saw, the politics were always at the motivation, certainly within, you know, what did you call it? The Earth Alliance. Thank you. Hello.
Yeah, right.
At a moment there, you know, in the separation and all that, that, you know, politics were at the core of it. So they, I guess maybe that's, well, that's yeah. up for you guys to debate if that was.
No, I hear what you're saying, Jeffrey.
Ambassadors than they were soldiers.
And I think that that's part of the, one of the elements about John Sheridan as a character is that his calling ultimately is more of statesman and leader of a vaster thing than simply a military commander. And, you know, I don't know. I think we see a little bit of it. You see Dr. Franklin's father, and I never got the sense that he was a jingoistic gung-ho type, but he was definitely enthusiastic about his command.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even to the point where Sheridan, you know, he's talking to Sheridan about his experience with that particular objective, and despite Sheridan's misgivings regarding it, he said, "Okay, well, we still got a job to do, and we're going to do it."
Yeah.
So.
Point taken.
I think we're starting to lose the Skype's starting to do weird things here.
It is.
I don't think so. I think you're just having a, you know, aged brain fart is what's going on here.
That could be. Yeah,
you're old now, Tim.
I know. I have to wrap my head around that.
And Summer and I are extremely patient people.
And I appreciate. what are we doing again?
Yeah. Huh.
Uh huh.
Right. The Deep Space Nine podcast. Keep going.
Oh, okay. Great.
That's one podcast you don't want me on.
We should do the Deep Space Nine, you know, like one episode.
It wasn't so bad until it started really copying Babylon 5.
Yeah.
No, seriously. Okay, we'll have the discussion now. While it wasn't perfect, there were many elements of the first year and a half of Deep Space Nine which I liked, because what that show was in the beginning looked to me like it was the aftermath of World War II. Germany's defeated. It's now occupied. You're dealing with the aftermath of an ugly situation. The Federation is coming in trying to put on a brave face on this, but they're, you know, they're faced with potential humanitarian crisis. There's moral conflicts. There was one episode, I think it was called Duet, where Major Kira gets into sort of a psychological battle with a gentleman who claims he was the Butcher of Galiatep, which was the equivalent of a Cardassian concentration camp. And it turns out really he was just a file clerk there who was so overwhelmed with the guilt of what happened there that, in, you know, to cross streams now, you know, where Jakar says, you know, you have an obligation to speak out, you know, and this is his way of trying to atone for his failure of conscience. And there was a lot of episodes early on that I liked like that, but then it's when it became the whole war with the Dominion, it was just Babylon 5 done poorly.
Oh boy, Tim, sit up straight. Your geek is showing.
Sorry. Let me arrange my shirt there.
Oh boy. That was a slippery slope. I'm so sorry, Summer. I really
am. I'm in full agreement. He obviously watched a lot more of the series than I did. I'm not that huge a Trek fan. I really am not. And it's, you know, a lot of people are surprised by that. I'm like, I'm sorry. It just never drew me in. I watched Next Generation because there was no other sci-fi on TV at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. There'll be an episode of feedback right there. Thanks a lot. Okay, what else you got, Tim?
That's it.
Yay! That's it.
Yeah, we're saving it all up for the Feedbackapalooza next week.
Awesome.
Oh, so next week is Feedbackapalooza.
Yeah, that's right. So you can have another one of your Diet Zima margaritas.
Okay, everybody. So send your questions to us, comments, thoughts, Deep Space Nine arguments with Tim, whatever. Yeah, get it to us.
Bring it on.
Well, I guess we have to like take a breather, take a breath, and just prepare ourselves mentally for the challenge that will be the next Feedbackapalooza. So right now is your chance to get your voicemails in, get your emails in, get your questions in, get your zingers in. You can send those emails to babylonpodcast@gmail.com, or you can send in those voicemails. That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year that Kashapalooza came upon us all.
Yes. And we'll see you next time on the other side of the Vorlon homeworld.